So welcome back to the Yale Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. Today, we're going to be doing a discussion about autoimmune encephalitides and paraneoplastic syndromes. My name is Aaron Bauer. I'm one of the PGY3 neurology residents here at Yale. Today, for this discussion, we'll have Dr. Moeller and Dr. Peters, one of our neuroimmunology fellows here at Yale.
Thank you for having me. I'm a longtime listener and happy to be a part of it.
So long-time listener, first-time caller, as they say.
Long-time first-time.
Yeah, long-time first-time. Well, I guess I'm a long-time, long-time. Thanks for having me, Aaron. I see my role as mainly a color commentary right now. I'm not an expert in these disorders, except those that do manifest as seizures and those I see in general neurology. But I think this is a great topic to cover, so I'm excited to hear what you come up with.
Well, thank you. It's definitely something that I particularly have an interest in and enjoy reading and discussing. So definitely more than happy to kind of walk through some of the more common syndromes that come up, at least maybe not clinically all the time, but definitely on tests and examinations. The general overview for how we're going to approach this will be a brief discussion, a little bit about the epidemiology, some of the pathophysiology of autoimmune disorders of the CNS and these more paraneoplastic syndromes. Then we'll briefly touch on some of the classic syndromes, the ones that come up most frequently from a testing perspective, some of their associated malignancies and presentation. And then at the end, we'll have a little bit of discussion regarding the general diagnostic approach and the treatment approach for these syndromes. So to start, just a little bit of framing in terms of epidemiology of some of these problems, particularly, you know, encephalitides and paraneoplastic syndromes, generally speaking, pretty rare disorders overall. Incidence about 1 out of 100,000 person years, prevalence somewhere around 4 out of 100,000 people. The thing is, though, as we've vastly increased our knowledge about these disorders in terms of their diagnosis and identification of syndromes, the trend has been increasing over the past years. So definitely becoming a problem that neurologists in training, and, you know, obviously neuroimmunologists are dealing with more commonly. Thinking about the pathophysiology of these diseases, generally it's a process that can be started and kind of continued in two different sites. And it kind of falls down on where ultimately the antibodies or the autoantibodies are directed. So this would either be intracellular or along the cell surface. And I think maybe Dr. Peters could kind of jump in here and kind of go through the difference between these two processes a little bit for us.
Yeah, so these are the two buckets that I like to put all of these disorders in. There's the, as you mentioned, the intracellular mediated processes where it's a CD8 positive cytotoxic T cell response. There are intracellular antigens. They're displayed on MHC class 1. And then there's a CD8 cytotoxic T cell mediated damage and cell death from there. And then contrasting from that, there's cell surface antigens for which there are antibodies directed against those plasma membrane antigens. There's specific populations of B cells that produce these autoantibodies and then lead to disrupting neuronal function and signaling and a whole cascade from there. And so for each of these syndromes, we're going to think about, are they more of an intracellular process or more of a cell surface process? And that's important because the intracellular ones are classically paraneoplastic in etiology. They are very commonly associated with malignancies, whereas the cell surface mechanism problems are more classically thought of as autoimmune syndromes where there is no clear association with malignancy and where immunotherapy is going to be the most critical for treatment.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a very good way to break down, at least from a pathophysiologic standpoint, these two major buckets, especially when thinking about kind of prognostication and treatments moving forward. In terms of actually going through the syndromes, we're going to try and break it down a little bit by the CNS. So more cortical syndromes going down and thinking about, you know, some movement disorders specifically, some more processes related to the cerebellum that are a little bit more specific, and then moving out to the peripheral nervous system from there, such as like neuromuscular junction and even a little bit of the muscle. I think most of the bulk of what we'll talk about will be some of these more cortical syndromes, but we'll definitely touch on some of the more peripheral ones too, at least that come up more frequently. There is a bit of a caveat when talking about these. So there are many antibodies that are associated with paraneoplastic syndromes and autoimmune processes. And obviously this is a list that is continually growing. So like I said, a lot of this will be focused more on the commonly tested by the antibodies and syndromes. John, would you be able to talk a little bit about kind of the general symptoms and red flags that you can think of, or when you're approaching somebody that you're more concerned with, like a cortical autoimmune process?
Yeah, so there's a few features to a patient's clinical presentation that are kind of, as you said, set off red flags in our minds to think of either paraneoplastic or autoimmune processes. First, the tempo of the process is generally going to be subacute. So taking symptoms that are occurring slowly over the course of days to weeks, occasionally as far as months. Patients will often have constitutional signs, things like weight loss, night sweats, and fatigue. And that obviously sets off a flag in our mind about a paraneoplastic process. And then we're always going to want to think about risk factors for cancer in patients. So whether or not they've been getting regular cancer screenings that are age appropriate, a family history of malignancy, and then other factors like smoking and things like that.
Yeah, and I guess regarding at least some of the autoimmune processes, anybody predisposed to one autoimmune disorder at least could be predisposed to others as well.
Absolutely.
I guess more broadly speaking.
Absolutely, yep.
So to start, I guess we can start look at some of the cortical processes. Big picture, a lot of autoimmune encephalitis, paraneoplastic encephalitis do have a bit of a predilection to the limbic lobes, so a limbic encephalitis. So generally speaking, with limbic encephalitis, we're seeing characteristic features kind of involving that pathway. So subacute mood changes, behavioral changes, some more cognitive dysfunction, and definitely some memory deficits as well, kind of tying into those mesial temporal lobe type of structures like the hippocampus and Pape's loop and all of that wonderfulness. There will be some MRI findings that we typically see that will be very characteristic, and EEG findings as well. So on MRI, Dr. Peters, what generally will we expect to see in more of a classic limbic encephalitis?
Yeah, the classic findings, you'll see temporal lobe flare hyperintensities, either unilateral or bilateral, but the MRI can be normal. And then on EEG, we often see sometimes nonspecific findings like generalized slowing, but then there can be more focal abnormalities in the temporal region, like focal epileptiform activity or focal slowing.
Yeah, I would add, just to pop in with my color commentary, limbic encephalitis is a disorder which, as you'll talk about, can have many causes, autoimmune, paraneoplastic, and I guess, strictly speaking, some viral encephalitis are limbic encephalitis, right? HSV encephalitis is a type of limbic encephalitis. It's acute and viral mediated. But the big triad that you're going to see with all three of these is some combination of behavior changes, usually in the sort of emotional affect kind of department. You're going to see seizures, which will be focal seizures of various types. And we'll talk about some specific types of seizures you can see with specific antibody-mediated processes. And then you're going to see cognitive dysfunction. And the specific cognitive dysfunction that you're going to see with limbic encephalitis is an amnestic memory problem. So the limbic circuits, those mesial temporal circuits, are important in encoding and retrieving declarative memory. And so people will experience dramatic changes in their ability to encode and retrieve declarative memory things. They'll forget what people told them. They'll forget names and words. They'll forget recent events, although more broadly encoded events, longer-term events will be still present and retrievable. And I will say, just as a public service announcement, we think about subacute limbic encephalitis in new onset seizures and new onset temporal lobe epilepsy, especially in the older age group, and especially in those who are not responding quickly to anti-seizure medications. So if you have somebody in middle or older age who has new onset seizures, whether or not there is an MRI abnormality, and you're also seeing worsening memory and mood disturbances, you really have to have a low threshold for thinking about an autoimmune process. So that triad, mood disturbances, memory, especially declarative memory problems, and focal temporal lobe seizures are the ways that you're going to identify a limbic encephalitis syndrome.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. That was fantastic. It's definitely a process that I've seen multiple times, at least in residency, and we'll definitely expect to see even more frequently coming up. So I think with that kind of as a broad kind of discussion about limbic encephalitis, we can talk about some of the more antibody-specific encephalitis moving forward. The first one we were going to talk about is one that I think most people have gotten a lot of familiarity with over time, and definitely is one that's frequently tested, and that would be NMDA encephalitis. So in this case, the antibody is directed against the ionotropic NMDA glutamate receptor that is found on the cell surface. So this is a cell surface mediated process. It can be associated with malignancy. The more classic association is an ovarian teratoma, usually seen in women kind of over 18. The association in men with malignancy is definitely less clear. The presentation, at least classically for NMDA encephalitis, this is usually kind of along that same timeline, so subacute process. There will be predominant psychosis, even to the degree of like a catatonia and encephalopathy. In the setting of NMDA, there's also seizures. There can be some oral facial dyskinesias, and pretty predominant dysautonomia can occur in these patients. They can become quite ill during their presentation. Seen a little bit of an association with like a central hypoventilation even, and just very high instability in kind of their autonomic system. So a lot of dysautonomia. And Dr. Peters, would you be able to comment a little bit kind of on the approach of diagnosis in this case and some findings that we can see on EEG?
Yeah. And just to key on what you said, you know, these patients can have an isolated limbic encephalitis, but it's these other features that you mentioned, the psychosis, the orofacial dyskinesias, the dysautonomia that clue us in that their limbic encephalitis may be due to NMDA receptor encephalitis. In terms of diagnosis, antillary tests with EEG and MRI are very helpful. We already talked about the MRI findings that can be seen in limbic encephalitis. In EEG, on EEG specifically, for NMDA receptor encephalitis, there's a pattern called the delta brush pattern, which is beta activity superimposed on delta activity that seems to be specific to some cases of NMDA receptor encephalitis.
So again, I'll jump in for some color commentary. So first, about half, I don't know about the most recent updates, but about half of patients are going to have a normal MRI with NMDA receptor mediated encephalitis. And the extreme delta brush is a pattern that is seen in later stages of this disorder when people are quite severely affected. So is not something that will play much of a role early on unless the patient regresses quite rapidly. The extreme delta brush is exciting. I was actually present, although not directly involved, when this was named. It was identified by a couple of my peers who were co-fellows and a group at Penn as well, and collected several cases with this specific pattern, which looks a little bit like delta brush, which is a pediatric EEG pattern. And again, it's seen in late stages. I think it was exciting because it really is the first new EEG finding, which is thought to be pathognomonic, that was described in, you know, decades, you know, something totally new, a new name for something on EEG. So I think this excited EEGers. But I wouldn't spend, not to disparage my colleagues, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time looking for extreme delta brush. When I have to put this together for exam purposes, I have to beg my colleagues to give me an example, because it seems like everybody's looking at the same example of somebody with late stage NMDA receptor encephalitis. And I'm sure you've both seen NMDA receptor encephalitis and probably have not seen actual real life examples of extreme delta brush. But if you do see this high voltage delta activity with superimposed fast activity on the peak of those delta waves in somebody with that triad of psychosis, autonomic disorders, and seizures, then of course it's going to be NMDA receptor encephalitis. But you probably don't even have to look at the EEG to know that.
Definitely a very fair point. I think I've seen a few cases of NMD, both in children and adults at this point, and I haven't seen that classic presentation on the EEG quite yet. And then there's also an association with HSV encephalitis. Isn't that correct, Dr. Peters?
That's right. Yeah. So in the past few years, there's been lots of new data showing that for patients who have recovered from HSV encephalitis, and then on average, about 4 to 6 weeks later, seem to have a relapse in the symptoms. They start to get more of the confusion, memory symptoms back, and start having new types of seizures. And it's been shown that the vast majority of these patients test positive for the NMDA receptor in their CSF, and when treated with immunotherapy, make great improvements. So there seems to be an association with recent HSV encephalitis and developing NMDA receptor encephalitis.
Yeah, that was definitely a newer thing that I learned going through this data preparing for this lecture. It's definitely not something that I had an association for in my head before. So definitely a good thing to keep in, you know, good thing to keep in the back of the head when approaching these patients who are recovering from these infectious encephalitis as well.
What one other just additional bit of context for NMDA receptor encephalitis? I think neurology residents are pretty keyed into this diagnosis. The vignettes that you'll see on exams, which I think reflect reality and certainly what's been reported, is that often these patients are admitted to psychiatric institutions, right? You might have a younger person with no history of neurological or psychiatric disease who has a subacute worsening psychiatric syndrome, and it's thought to be first presentation of psychosis. This is one of the reasons that I always tell the residents, I am certainly a true believer and will never give any pushback to anybody who requests an EEG in a psychiatric institution for their patient with new psychosis, and to anybody who requests a neurological consultation for a patient with new psychosis. And there are many reports of patients who had a delay to their diagnosis of an NMDA receptor encephalitis because they were being treated for a primary psychiatric disorder. And sadly, there are probably still some patients who are being treated for a psychiatric disorder who are missed diagnosis or later diagnosis of NMDA receptor encephalitis. And we've all seen that this is a disorder that can sneak up on you because of its subacute onset and because sometimes it has prominent psychiatric symptoms early on.
I completely agree. We briefly touched on the diagnosis, but I have a very low threshold for recommending lumbar punctures to test for the CSF NMDA receptor antibody, which is the most sensitive and specific test for diagnosing NMDA receptor encephalitis. But for patients, exactly as you said, Dr. Moeller, very low threshold for EEG and CSF testing.
No, I think that's a really good point to keep in mind when approaching these patients, and particularly patients that we're getting consulted on in psychiatry. It's definitely a syndrome that we've become much more familiar with and definitely can change a patient's outcome dramatically moving down the line. So I think moving on to the next kind of encephalitis that has been at least come up pretty frequently, especially on in the testing scenarios, would be LGI1 encephalitis, so leucine-rich glioma inactivated 1 encephalitis. So once again, this is an antibody. It's directed against a voltage-gated potassium channel, also on the cell surface. The malignancy with this one is a little less common, but can be seen with thymoma, but it's usually only around the order of like 5 to 10% of cases. The presentation for LGI1 related encephalitis is you're going to have that limbic encephalitis. So that picture we kind of discussed and set up in the beginning. The thing that's generally mentioned the most in terms of a testing scenario and a clinical scenario that can lead somebody to think about this disorder specifically are facio-brachial dystonic seizures. Maybe we can have Dr. Moeller kind of describe these a little bit. It's something that I haven't particularly seen in person.
Yeah, and I think that you might not have seen them because we pick up on this diagnosis sometimes earlier, although it is something to think about. So these are a type of focal aware seizure. So they're not associated with loss of consciousness. They're very brief, typically, usually far less than a minute, and sometimes only a handful of seconds. They are focal motor seizures, which have components of tonic or dystonic posturing affecting the face and the upper arm. And that's why facio-brachiodystonic and sometimes the entirety of the arm. They often happen in clusters and can happen, you know, up to many, many times an hour, you know, every few minutes. And the other clue that you may be dealing with an autoimmune syndrome is by report in the literature, they really don't respond all that well to anti-seizure medications. The way to stop these seizures is by treating with immune modulating therapy. And you're going to talk about treatment, but self-surface antigen, this tends to be supremely responsive to even things like corticosteroids.
Very true. We'll touch on the treatment a little bit. Outside of the seizures, the classic seizures for this syndrome, you can also see some myoclonus, you know, more basic lab work. There is an association with hyponatremia. And they can have some sleep behavior disorder as well, more classically like a REM sleep behavior disorder. And Dr. Peters, if you could just touch a little bit on maybe some of the treatment, at least that's a little bit more specific for the LGI1 encephalitis.
Yeah, as Dr. Moeller mentioned, this is a condition that is very responsive to immunotherapy, in especially in the acute setting, either with high dose intravenous steroids or IVIG. And I would just say that this is like a perfect syndrome to that's it's like tailor-made for testing purposes, because it's patients have this general presentation with limbic encephalitis, but there are key features that are pathognomonic for LGI1, the facio-brachial dystonic seizures, hyponatremia, REM sleep behavior disorder, all the things that can clue test takers into the answer being LGI1.
All right. So next we'll head into some more less commonly thought about autoimmune encephalitis. One syndrome that I came across while preparing this is actually called Ophelia syndrome. So this is an autoimmune process. The antibody in this case is going to be against a glutamate receptor, so mGlu-R5 specifically. This receptor actually has a pretty high concentration in like the hippocampus and amygdala. And the associated malignancy is actually Hodgkin's lymphoma. So you can see this syndrome particularly in patients coming in with a Hodgkin's lymphoma. The presentation you'll see here, given where this receptor is most frequently expressed, you can kind of make a few assumptions about the syndrome. So there's a lot of memory deficits, hallucinations, delusions. So a lot of these kind of limbic processes, so kind of similar to these limbic encephalitides that we discussed earlier. And very bizarre behavior and delusions can kind of come out of this presentation as well. It's actually named after Ophelia from Hamlet, and was first described actually by a Dr. Carr, and it was actually in his daughter, his 15-year-old daughter, who actually developed Hodgkin's lymphoma and then this kind of cognitive syndrome afterwards and responded very well to treatment.
I'm just looking at the original paper in The Lancet from 1982, taking a little bit of a deep dive into the syndrome. So Canadian moment, this was a pathologist based in the University of Saskatchewan, was Ian Carr. So just FYI, all the great things come out of Canada. And it's a very personal essay. It's under the personal papers within The Lancet. And it's a very personal essay about this very unusual behavior change in his daughter, in his teenage daughter, who otherwise never had any behavioral problems. So again, going back, a little reference back to the fact that when you have these young adults or teenagers who have a sudden change that's inexplicable, you have to think about an autoimmune disorder. And in this patient, she, over a period of months, from what it looks like, developed some regression in her schoolwork, forgetfulness, and then other sort of behavioral changes, sort of some withdrawal. And it took a long time to get to the diagnosis of Hodgkin's lymphoma. One interesting thing, again, I'll attribute this to Dr. Carr, but I think this really tells you about this amnestic syndrome and this problem with encoding. And getting back to the limbic system, I'll read one of the final paragraphs. She struggled back to normality, her mind returning to normal as her hair did. A year later, the only apparent mental abnormality was a neatly excised piece of memory for about 18 months. The factual information had been relearned, the personal development re-undertaking. Only a bit of life was missing. And I think that's really a nice description of an amnestic syndrome. She had a limbic encephalitis. She was unable to encode new declarative memory. And so there really was no film in the camera for those 18 months. And so she was able to regain her neurological function. But of course, she would never remember the events of the time during which she had the limbic encephalitis. And it was only later that this was found to be related to an autoantibody that can be seen in Hodgkin lymphoma, which is the GluR5, right? The mGluR5 antibody, which I guess is expressed preferentially in limbic structures like the hippocampus and amygdala. But I think that's a really interesting observation. And it's nice to go back to the papers and look at them with today's lens and see, oh yeah, it's clear she had a limbic encephalitis. And only in retrospect does that become clear.
Definitely going through some of these older cases, there one attending here, Dr. Baring, does this quite frequently. And it's definitely a good thing to kind of step back and kind of see where these initial presentations come from with a lens now with the additional diagnostics that we have. So I think moving on, the next syndrome, at least in the cortical setting, it would be DPPX. So Dr. Peters, would you like to talk about this one a little bit?
Yeah, so this is another more recently described syndrome. It's an antibody against the voltage-gated potassium channel or part of that on the cell surface. Because it's a cell surface mediated encephalitis, there are just rare associations with malignancy, but there might be a sign that they're associated with B cell neoplasms in rare circumstances. And what sets DPPX encephalitis, kind of the key features to that is that there is often a preceding GI symptoms. So patients will have months of diarrhea, weight loss, and then ensuing after that will develop limbic encephalitis with confusion and the other features we've described. Other unique features to DPPX is that patients can have this kind of global CNS hyperexcitability. They can have myoclonus, tremor, seizures. And so it's kind of some unique components to it that can help clue in that DPPX might be the highest suspicion.
Yeah, this was definitely one that I hadn't really come across before outside of some questions that I was doing. I think it's definitely one that has some of the preceding features, especially with the GI symptoms that are described and some of the CNS hyperexcitability, is definitely one at least that can clue you in if that's kind of the diagnosis that we're getting at. And then the last kind of cortical syndrome that we wanted to talk or at least mention would be the antibodies directed against GABA receptors. So the GABA-A and GABA-B associated encephalitides. So in this case, the antibody, like I said, directed against the GABA receptors, given the GABA receptors, is going to be on the cell surface. Difference between GABA-A and GABA-B. So GABA-A, if we remember going back a little bit away to the more basic physiology, it's going to be a ligand-gated chloride channel. And GABA-B is going to be a metabotropic receptor. So kind of walking along those G protein receptor pathways. And this one's going to be an inhibitory G protein. There is an association with malignancy in this case. In the setting of GABA-A, there's some less common association with possibly thymoma. But GABA-B actually does have a relationship with small cell lung cancer. About half of the cases are thought to be paraneoplastic in this setting, at least. And the thing that really sets apart GABA-A and GABA-B related encephalitides is they just very prominent seizures and status epilepticus. So this is usually something that can come up in the consideration in like a NORS patient. So a new onset refractory status epilepticus patient is definitely something that we should think about at least in these patients, kind of as Dr. Moeller has alluded to previously in this discussion. And in terms of MRI findings, this actually can differentiate them a little bit. So in the case of GABA-A, the hyperintensities you see are actually usually more multifocal. So you'll have a lot of T2 hyperintensities kind of throughout the brain, while GABA-B is actually a little bit more localized to the mesial temporal structure. So kind of more along that limbic encephalitis pathway. And with that said, we will expect those associated symptoms that we've kind of more broadly characterized as a limbic encephalitis in the case of these encephalitides as well, related to GABA-A and GABA-B. So the next cortical syndrome that we're going to talk about is actually going to be anti-MA. So I'm going to actually have Dr. Peters kind of talk about this one a little bit briefly.
Yeah, so anti-MA2 or MA2 associated encephalitis commonly presents with a limbic encephalitis like we've discussed with those classic symptoms and associated MRI abnormalities. Some unique features to anti-MA is that patients can have kind of sleep-related issues with excessive daytime somnolence. They can have eye movement abnormalities, like particularly a vertical gaze palsy. And that can even progress to like a full external ophthalmoplegia. And a key kind of association with anti-MA is the associated malignancy with it, which is testicular germ cell tumors, most common in young men. Anti-MA is unique in that it is very responsive to oncologic and immunologic therapy. So if that testicular germ cell tumor is treated, usually short-term immunotherapy is provided, patients can make a very significant recovery.
Oh, fantastic. I appreciate you helping add this one in there too. It's definitely a syndrome that I'm not as familiar with. So I appreciate that. So moving to more of the movement disorders. So these are going to be more autoimmune processes and paraneoplastic processes are associated with predominant movement disorders. So the first one I want to talk about is pretty classic. So opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome. I feel most of our listeners will probably have heard about this one. So the major antibodies that can be seen with it would be in children. We actually can see a bit of a relationship with ANA, so ANA1 or anti-HU. And in adults, we actually can see it a little bit with like ANA2 or anti-RE. And both of which are going to be an intracellular process in terms of where the antibody is directed. I will say as a caveat, generally speaking, opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome can be antibody negative. But when there is an antibody present, usually it will be either ANA1 or ANA2 kind of along that age group. And Dr. Peters, would you be able to touch a little bit on kind of the malignancy associations with these?
Yeah, so in children, it is classically associated with neuroblastomas. And so in terms of workup, it's going to be some type of abdominal imaging will be necessary. And in adults, opsoclonus myoclonus can be seen associated with breast cancers, with that anti-Re antibody, ovarian cancers, or small cell lung cancer.
Yeah, and then in terms of actually what opsoclonus myoclonus is, so opsoclonus, you're going to see this repetitive, involuntary, usually rhythmic, multi-directional saccades in the eyes. And obviously, myoclonus, you'll have those very brief, rapid jerks that we've kind of discussed in our previous episode, both either positive or negative in terms of kind of the action of the muscles. Some additional things you can see with this, more generally speaking, the patients can have a bit of ataxia. It'll usually be more axial and truncal. And they can also have more just a generalized encephalopathic picture as well. Interestingly, the previous kind of nomenclature for it was dancing eyes, dancing feet, sign of getting at the movement of the eyes, the opsoclonus, and the dancing feet, kind of this myoclonic process as well. In terms of movement disorder predominant syndromes, the next one we'll talk about is going to be progressive encephalomyelitis with rigidity and myoclonus, or PERM. The antibody in this case will actually be a glycine receptor, so glycine alpha. This is going to be, once again, a cell surface process. And glycine alpha receptor is more of a inhibitory ligand-gated ion channel. It's actually more predominantly seen in like the spine and brainstem. In terms of malignancy association here, we'll occasionally see it in the setting of a thymoma or even Hodgkin's lymphoma. So Dr. Peters, would you be able to chat a little bit about what's seen with this process?
Yeah, so in PERM syndrome, there can be some overlap with what we'll talk about, I think, next, which is stiff person syndrome. But these patients often present with pronounced rigidity, these painful muscle spasms, myoclonus, and then more kind of central findings of brainstem dysfunction and encephalopathy, which can be very, very prominent and very severe.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. It's mostly just kind of symptoms that you'd expect based on where those receptors are. And we can kind of use this to tie in with stiff person syndrome, which is a similar autoimmune paraneoplastic process that is associated with a few antibodies. The more common ones are going to be GAD65 and amphiphysin, which both of these are going to be intracellular kind of antibody-mediated processes. GAD is a glutamic acid decarboxylase. It's actually an enzyme that's kind of involved in GABA synthesis. And then amphiphysin is a protein that's actually more important kind of in the process of endocytosis. Malignancies in this case are going to be lung cancer associations, neuroendocrine tumors, thymoma, breast. And generally speaking, the malignancy association would be much higher and more frequent with the amphiphysin antibody, more so than GAD. And the presentation here, kind of along the lines of PERM syndrome, it's going to be progressive muscle stiffness. Generally speaking, it presents asymmetrically first with a lot of rigidity and spasms. And those spasms can be both spontaneous or stimuli induced.
Yeah, just some clinical pearls with the stiff person syndrome. The first being often very prominent rigidity within the abdomen and back. So often the torso is very stiff. Somebody sort of standing up straight or sitting up very straight. That's sort of the classic presentation. The stimulus-induced stiffness is actually an interesting phenomenon. And in the early literature around stiff person syndrome, there were descriptions of this being misdiagnosed as a psychogenic or psychiatric disease because it was provoked by tactile stimulation, or in some cases, even by emotional stimulation or auditory stimulation. Loud noises, sudden shock would set off this sudden muscle spasm that would involve a number of muscles and make the person very stiff. And this seemed very bizarre. And before the syndrome was characterized, it was sometimes misdiagnosed as psychogenic. The last thing I'll say is that there's some debate about anti-GAD-associated neurological disease, including stiff persons. As you've said before, glutamic acid decarboxylase is an intracellular protein. So this would be an intracellular antigen. And there's some discussion about whether GAD65 antibodies are actually an epiphenomenon, that there is cellular damage and release of GAD, and therefore a secondary immune response, which gives you those GAD antibodies. And for test takers, GAD65 antibodies are seen in a portion of people with type 1 diabetes. and usually at lower titers than in the autoimmune encephalitides, than in stiff person syndrome and other GAD-associated neurological disease. And GAD65-associated neurological disease includes classically stiff person syndrome, can also include alembic encephalitis, which can be difficult to treat, can also include cerebellar degeneration, which you're going to get to next, and other syndromes. So GAD65, you can see a lot of different things. And there's some debate about whether it's actually the GAD that's the player in all of that.
Yeah, this is a commonly encountered issue in the neuroimmunology field. Is this antibody truly the pathogenic player, or is it just a bystander? And GAD65 is probably the most common one that comes up as the question. One thing I'll just add to our discussion about stiff person syndrome is that this very, very painful and debilitating muscle rigidity and spasms can be very responsive to benzodiazepines. So a lot of patients are treated with those to help manage the spasms.
And often high doses are required.
So the next process that's a little bit more related to some movement problems is actually going to be IGLON-5. So this is an antibody directed against a cell adhesion molecule. There really isn't a clear malignancy in this case, but the presentation that is actually pretty pathognomonic for it, you'll have these abnormal sleep movements and behavior. So they'll have a lot of REM, non-REM, parasomnias, even OSA, also a lot of bulbar symptoms. So there's been descriptions of oculomotor problems, a lot of predominant dysarthria, dysphagia, even to the point of like stridor. From a motor perspective, they'll have a lot of CNS hyperexcitability. So hyperplexia, myoclonus, and even some chorea has been described in these patients. And in the setting of IGLON-5, just being a cortical syndrome, there is a degree of cognitive impairment and encephalopathy. Interestingly, it can kind of look like a PSP, so a progressive supranuclear palsy, when it's initially presenting. It can lead to a lot of questions about what the diagnosis is and the approach to it.
The takeaway would be somebody with an unexplained, apparently neurodegenerative process with prominent sleep disturbances and bulbar symptoms, right? You know, you're going to start to think about IGLON-5. This is something that was new on my radar within the last few years, but it is very interesting as a potentially treatable cause for this type of problem.
So I think we're kind of starting to move outside of the cortical syndromes and the movement syndromes that we wanted to touch on. So next, we'll kind of describe a more broad entity that's associated with a lot of different antibodies. So subacute cerebellar degeneration. So in this syndrome, the presentation generally will be subacute, so similar tempo as we've kind of been discussing, but a lot of cerebellar findings. So there will be some, you know, nystagmus, gait instability, ataxia. And then you can also get some related dysarthria, dysphagia, and kind of associated in those, you know, posterior fossa and cerebellar processes, there can be complaints of dizziness, vertigo. And one interesting finding that some patients may describe is a little bit of oscillopsia. So that's kind of the sensation that the surrounding environment is almost like constantly in motion. And correct me if I'm wrong, that's a little bit of tying into kind of those cerebellar and visual pathways.
Yeah, you know, oscillopsia is the symptom and either nystagmus or some saccadic abnormality is the sign. I think they're the same things, right? If your eyes are moving around, then you're going to experience a sensation as if the images are flickering or moving around as well.
Dr. Peters, would you be able to comment a little bit on some of the antibodies and any malignancy associations in this case?
Yeah, so I think cerebellar degeneration is a good example of a syndrome of which there are many different pathological antibodies that are possibilities. So the classic one that I think of is anti-YO or YO, and it's associated with breast cancer and other, and also gynecological cancers. But then there are many others. So there's anti-MGlu-R1. It can be seen in anti-HU, and anti-TR, and then other antibody-mediated syndromes. But this is why nowadays most often we test these patients with antibody panels. So you're not trying to rack your brain, think of every single antibody. You can just send an entire panel for a paraneoplastic or autoimmune syndrome and have it evaluated that way.
Yeah, especially as we move forward and continue to find more antibodies. I mean, part of this process is going to be continue to be kind of a broad workup. So moving forward, now that we've kind of talked about most of the CNS presentations and syndromes are going to start looking more towards the peripheral nervous system. So the first syndrome we wanted to touch on a little bit that's commonly tested because of some key features is going to be Morvan syndrome. So in this case, antibody will generally be against anti-Caspar-2. This is a voltage-gated potassium channel. It's located on the cell surface. There is a associated malignancy with thymoma. Maybe Dr. Peters could talk a little bit about the presentation for Morvan syndrome.
Yeah. So Morvan syndrome specifically is when there are anti-Caspar-2 antibodies, as you mentioned, and then this characteristic feature of this peripheral nerve hyperexcitability. So patients will have myokymia, which is like a bag of worms type muscle movement, kind of this writhing little wiggling underneath their skin. They can have like prominent neuropathic pain. They can have autonomic instability, hyperhidrosis. And then it's also associated with CNS symptoms of limbic encephalitis, and they can have prominent insomnia and hallucinations.
Maybe Dr. Moeller, would you be able to comment slightly on some of the EMG findings associated with this?
I'm not an EMG-er, but this is from what I've read and I think are basically the electrical analogs or correlates of the myokymia. So you can actually see myokymia on EMG. That's a characteristic finding. And then you can see other spontaneous activity. So, and all of that is likely related to peripheral nerve hyperexcitability. So there are ways in which neurophysiologists can identify peripheral nerve hyperexcitability by seeing an increase in certain types of spontaneous discharges, including higher frequency spontaneous discharges at rest or with brief stimulation.
Fantastic. So that's Morvan syndrome, more or less, kind of in a nutshell. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about sensory neuronopathy. There can be several antibodies involved here, but one of the more classic ones that people will be tested on would be in the setting of an anti-ANA1 or anti-HU. So we've kind of mentioned this before. So anti-HU is an intracellular-related antibody and does have more associations outside of just this peripheral case, and is associated with several malignancies, including small cell lung cancer, neuroblastoma, and breast. The presentation in this setting will be painful paresthesias and a predominant sensory ataxia to the point where some of these people actually have like a pseudo-athetosis. So like those writhing movements in the fingers, but it's in the setting of just profound sensory loss. And more broadly speaking, outside of these sensory findings, they can have involvement in the brainstem. So you can think about bulbar symptoms, cerebellar findings, kind of along with the subacute cerebellar degeneration we previously described, and also pretty involved autonomic dysfunction, almost similar to the anti-NMDA, as we've kind of discussed previously.
Yes, anti-HU or anti-ANA1, I think of as the classic intracellular process or paraneoplastic syndrome. It has a clear association with small cell lung cancer. It has these sensory neuronopathy findings, but it can be, as you said, multifocal or just an isolated limbic encephalitis, for example. And it's another, it's a good example of how these nervous system manifestations can precede a diagnosis of cancer. And so if someone presents with symptoms that are consistent with this, obviously you want to look right away for any evidence of malignancy. But even if there is none at the initial presentation, for 3-6 months down the line, you want to reinvestigate, do another set of malignancy screenings to see if anything is developed in the meantime, because these symptoms can precede the diagnosis of cancer by several months.
That's a very good point to keep in mind. The just degree of suspicion with some of these processes will be important, diagnostically speaking. We're down to kind of the last two sections in this discussion. We're going to be talking briefly about kind of some neuromuscular junction disorders and muscle disorders that are associated more commonly with paraneoplastic and autoimmune processes. So at the neuromuscular junction, we'll talk about one that I assume most people will know who's listening to this podcast at this point, but Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, so LEMS, and one that's maybe a little bit more uncommon, but a ganglionic acetylcholine receptor antibody syndrome. So in Lambert-Eaton, just to remind everyone, this is a process where the antibody is directed against the anti-voltage gated calcium channel, so on the cell surface. This, mind you, is on the presynaptic neuromuscular junction and is responsible for calcium influx that's necessary for the ultimate synaptic transmission, so vesicular binding to the cell membrane. Malignancy association here, generally small cell lung cancer presentation, is going to be your typical kind of thought process you have for a neuromuscular junction disorder. So proximal dependent muscle weakness, in this case, usually a little bit more predominant in the lower extremities than upper. There will be some bulbar weakness and areflexia can be seen. One more characteristic feature that may clue somebody in towards more of a Lambert-Eaton compared to myasthenia would be more predominant autonomic dysfunction at times as well. In terms of the classical findings for this, EMG, so with more low frequency stimulation, so repetitive nerve stimulation around 2 to 3 hertz, we'll actually see a decremental CMAP response. So the motor response will be decreasing with that stimulation. And then the CMAP or the motor response at high frequency, so 50 hertz, or after exercise, you'll see an increase. And generally the cutoff is around greater than 100% increase. One thing that does commonly come up in terms of exams for this is the treatment. So there is some treatment for Lambert-Eaton outside of taking care of malignancy, taking care of the underlying process. You would be able to treat a little bit with 3,4-diaminopyridine. This essentially blocks potassium ion channels, so that prolongs depolarization and increases the essentially amount of open time of those calcium channels to help kind of get at the underlying dysfunction at those calcium channels. Any additional stuff from you all on that one? So the next one kind of at the neuromuscular junction that maybe comes up a little less commonly is actually antibodies directed against the acetylcholine receptors. So here we'll actually have antibodies against the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. It's going to be on the cell surface at the neuromuscular junction that can be associated with thymoma, small cell lung cancer, and adenocarcinomas. The presentation here is going to be predominant autonomic symptoms. So orthostatic hypotension, Sika syndrome, poorly reactive pupils, and anhidrosis. You can also obviously get a lot of urinary and GI symptoms as well. So you can have patients that will develop a neurogenic bladder in this case and can have a lot of upper and even lower GI dysfunction in the setting of this syndrome. A little less common, but definitely wanted to mention.
Yes, this is one I initially, when I first learned about it, was like, isn't that just myasthenia gravis? Isn't that an autoantibody against the acetylcholine receptor? But this was specifically, this syndrome is against ganglionic receptors in that autonomic ganglion. And that's what clues you into the presentation of this profound orthostasis and autonomic instability.
Now, for the sake of this conversation, we will kind of like table myasthenia's relationship with thymoma, just because that's kind of out of the scope already, at least for what we wanted to keep for this conversation. But just to kind of touch on one antibody or autoimmune mediated process at the site of the muscle, when it's commonly associated with malignancy, would be dermatomyositis. So in this case, there are actually quite a few antibodies that may be associated with dermatomyositis. One of them is going to be anti-Me2 as an example, and that one can be associated with some adenocarcinomas. And the presentation here, just to review, is going to be a combination of skin findings and, you know, muscle localized weakness. So very proximal muscle weakness, and the characteristic signs that can help clue you in clinically or on a test are going to be this rash, kind of along erythematous rash along the upper eyelids, and that's called the heliotrope erythematous rash. You'll have these also erythematous regions kind of over the MCP and ICP. And those are referred to as Dagotrans papules. And then you can have a rash kind of along the back and upper neck, and that's referred to kind of as the Shaw sign. So kind of a rash that's described along where a Shaw would lie, essentially. And this one is going to be definitely managed a little bit more along the lines of a neuromuscular specialist. So Dr. Peter, you think it's a good time to talk more broadly about the diagnostic considerations and some of the subtleties in the way we approach these processes?
Yeah, so we've covered a lot of specific antibody syndromes, and we talked a little bit at the beginning about when you suspect these, so a subacute onset, maybe or maybe not, there's signs of malignancy or brewing malignancy. But then let's say you suspect more broadly, maybe an autoimmune limbic encephalitis, how are you going to get the diagnosis? So we talked a little bit about ancillary testing with MRI findings, which can be normal or can show T2 hyperintensities in the temporal lobes. EEG, we talked about either some specific findings or more generalized findings of generalized slowing or focal slowing. And then for all these patients, you're going to want to do CSF testing. And generally, you'll see a mildly elevated white blood cell count, usually predominantly lymphocytes, but generally it's going to be under 50 to 100 cells, even in the acute setting. Patients will either have normal or maybe a mildly elevated CSF protein, and then usually a normal glucose. I often recommend sending oligoclonal banding on patients where an autoimmune encephalitis is suspected, because you can see CSF-specific oligoclonal bands in these settings. So that's the kind of classic neurology triad that you want to send on pretty much all of these patients, an MRI, an EEG, and lumbar puncture for CSF testing. But normal testing on all these doesn't exclude an autoimmune encephalitis. So I've certainly seen many patients with that a classic presentation where they have normal CSF labs, they have a normal MRI, and they have a normal EEG. And so you still want to be clued into that being a possibility.
Maybe then, for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with some of the CSF testing, what exactly do the oligoclonal bands kind of refer to?
So that is when you are measuring CSF immunoglobulins in the spinal fluid and comparing them to the serum. So you're going to do a blood draw at the same time. And if there are isolated bands, usually there's more than one, so we call it an oligoclonal bands in the spinal fluid, that's a sign that there's inflammation that's restricted to the central nervous system and can be seen in, obviously, classically in multiple sclerosis, but it is not specific to MS and can be seen in autoimmune encephalitis as well.
Paring down to just like intrathecal, so CNS-specific immunoglobulin production.
Exactly. Yep.
And could you maybe talk a little bit about some of the antibody testing? I know we touched on it a little bit earlier, but what you do with some of these titers that are in between, or like when and how we should approach testing these antibodies.
Yeah. So when you're suspecting either a paraneoplastic or autoimmune syndrome, ideally you would send out a panel of antibodies. There are commercially available panels for specific syndromes. So there are panels for cerebellar degeneration. There are panels for autoimmune encephalitis. There are panels for a suspected paraneoplastic encephalitis. In general, it's best to send testing on both serum and CSF simultaneously, because it is a panel and some antibodies are more sensitive in the serum and some are more sensitive in the CSF. So it's best to send both at the same time so you're not missing something. As we mentioned, a negative antibody test does not preclude a diagnosis of autoimmune or paraneoplastic syndrome or paraneoplastic encephalitis. There are constantly new antibodies being discovered. And so if you have a high suspicion, empiric treatment in the setting of a negative antibody panel may be warranted.
And then just to kind of round out our discussion, maybe we can talk a little bit about the broad treatment considerations, more specific to kind of the more CNS-related processes.
Yeah, so we have our two buckets that we've been going through, these cell surface-mediated kind of classic autoimmune encephalitides, and then we have our paraneoplastic. And so for the paraneoplastic bucket, they generally do not respond as well to treatment, but the key for those is going to be treating the underlying malignancy at the same time as you're treating the immune pathology. So for those patients, you're going to be collaborating with oncology to manage the underlying malignancy while pursuing immunotherapy as well. And then for our other bucket, our autoimmune encephalitis, that's where dedicated immune therapy is going to be most effective. Most of our understanding on how to treat these patients comes from treating NMDA receptor encephalitis, as that's the most common. In the acute setting, using high-dose intravenous steroids, IVIG, or plasmapheresis is most effective. In severe cases, so for example, in severe cases of NMDA receptor encephalitis, there is good data to support early use of rituximab, even in the acute setting, and depleting B cells to stop the autoantibody-mediated process. So that's the acute setting. And then for chronic therapy, some patients do not require chronic immunosuppressants, but some do. And in those cases, we often use rituximab, but can also use cyclophosphamide, azathioprine, methotrexate, and other immunotherapy.
Yeah, it's actually been very nice going through training, seeing a lot of patients on the wards who come in with these encephalitides. Then they sometimes have a very protracted hospital course, but then being able to see them in the follow-up and see kind of the slow recovery and sometimes even profound recovery is really something that I found interested rotating through some of the neuroimmunology clinics.
A lot of these patients with cell surface mediated issues like NMDA receptor encephalitis, LGI-1 can make great recoveries, and it's night and day to how they look in the acute setting. And then even in just a few months follow-up, the goal and hopefully, with treatment and time, they're they come back as close to normal as they can.
Well, thank you, Dr. Peters. That's been an absolutely fantastic conversation and a chance to get to talk with you about some of these more commonly seen and commonly tested syndromes. Hopefully it'll provide a good overview for a lot of people preparing moving forward.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.